Well, thank you very much. I'm sure there'll be someone here who knows far more than me about most of the things I'll touch on, but nevertheless, it should be interesting to have a look at sort of survey of all the sort of things that come in at quite an elementary level. That's the idea, is to make everything easy. But what's not easy, I suppose, about projective spaces is just that we're dealing not with numbers, but with equivalence classes. It's always difficult, any mathematical structure where you've got equivalence classes rather than the primary things which are quantities. And we have that in gauge theory anyway, because that's what a gauge field is. It's the equivalence class with lots of different representatives, and if you do a gauge fixing, then we choose a particular representative in a defined way and so forth. And that's hard. I mean, that's difficult. That's what we grapple with. But it's a lot easier, really, in projective spaces because the objects that we're trying to represent are very familiar to us. They're just ratios of numbers, and ratio is an easy idea. In fact, I started my last talk with an observation that harmony, which is the subject of our workshop, is itself a projective structure. And I just happened to come in here, and I noticed, actually very nicely, just lying on the top here, as an example of this, I'm trying to encourage you to think that projective spaces are all things that people use all the time without realizing it. And here indeed is a little piece of music, apparently called Autumn Leaves, and the instructions to the pianist have things like G major 7, and that indeed is a projective structure which is independent of the bass note, and that means the whole class of ratio is a single set of ratios but independent of pitch, and then the G tells you at what pitch to put it. So that actually is a product space of a pitch and then a projective mechanism. Yeah. And that's so people do this all the time, and of course they use some funny logarithmic notation, which is what that 7 is for explaining the ratios, but that's a secondary detail. The point is it is really a projective structure. Of course, harmony, one example, cookery recipes is another, I suppose voting systems is another one. People are quite used to all these things. And I noticed one that comes up in the newspapers, every day there's a table like this. I don't know if anyone will recognize what this is. This is the one. It changes every day. This is quite instructive, actually. Something's gone wrong with that ship. I think that should be there. Anyone see what this projective structure is? We're all experts on projective spaces. These are, we read them, these are columns. So these are for each. Any suggestions? Oh, well. Well, there. If I write pound, dollar, euro, yen. And this is an example. I mean, each of these columns represents the same ratio, written out in different representations for the benefit of different audiences. And, of course, it is the ratios that are important, not the absolute values. And that's what people actually use. In fact, if you have a portfolio of X1 pounds and X2 dollars, X3 euros, X4 yen, how do you measure the value of that? Well, you do this projective operation. You dot the X vector into the C. Each of these is a representation of the projective object, projective vector C, and you divide that by whatever base that gives the value of your portfolio in dollars, because I've chosen to take the dollar vector. Well, that's the vector 0.1. And I could do that for any other. So that's actually what you're doing when you use this table. And of course, the thing that strikes one is that this function of homogeneity 0 in the vector is typical for what we get in using projective spaces. That's something that then is independent of the representation of the vector. Whether I use this column or this column or this column or this column, I'll get the same answer. And that's the principle of it. So it's something people are entirely familiar with. Of course, the fact that currencies actually move in a projective space gives rise to a lot of problems. I mean, people don't realize this and talk about a currency going up or down. Actually, every day they just jiggle around as a point in this projective space. And the ordinary language doesn't actually do justice to the geometry that's involved here. And for instance, you notice that sometimes talk about competitive devaluation, and all currencies devalue at the same time. Of course, they end up exactly where they were. And that's a concept which is difficult to express in ordinary language, but which is entirely natural in a projective space. But I won't go on about that, because obviously this is trivial. This isn't really what we want to be talking about. But it's a nice example of how the concepts, actually slightly non-trivial concepts about ratios, do come into ordinary life all the time. And when I remember when I was at school and had a chapter in the book on ratios and proportion, I thought, this is silly. I mean, what do I want to know about this thing, about this ratio symbol like this? It's just fractions. I know about fractions already. What is there to ratios that there isn't already in learning about A over B and B over A? Is there anything? Well, I was nearly right. I mean, it is almost, but not quite, because the whole problem here, the whole problem of projective spaces and everything to do with projective spaces arises because one of the A and B can be zero. And it's really these zero ratios which are the thing that make projective geometry non-trivial. In fact, the reason why this is really trivial and not a proper example of what we're doing with projective spaces is that we have certain preferred elements of the space of, I mean, the x1, x2, x3, and x4 could be positive, they could be negative, because they could be debts as well as assets. But so you can be sure, at least you can reasonably be sure, that none of these objects themselves is going to become worthless or negative value. So that you can be sure that these numbers in this table are going to be positive, not zero, so there's no harm. You can always multiply and divide freely by these things. The whole problem about projective spaces is that we may have ratios involved which have zeros in, and then you can't do these divisions because one of these numbers is naught, and then you can't do one of the divisions. And that trivial point is really the foundation of all the subtlety that's there in projective spaces. So let's study that properly rather than one of these jokey remarks. And of course, you could actually run into problems if you were running a financial company, as these people do, with a product which consisted of an asset in one currency and a debt in another, and you wanted to trade your product with that of a rival company which had a different product, then these ratios could indeed have just this problem. So you would actually run into the problem of how to represent your trading position, because you wouldn't always be able to division. Your product might be, dare I say, completely worthless. And indeed, something like this does seem to have happened within the financial system at various points. All right, so our point is that we might be considering, typically we're considering ratios like this, but so we've got to allow for the possibility that one of these numbers may be naught, in which case we can't, and that's perfectly all right, as long as not all of these are zero. We go two of them to be naught, and that's also got to be, makes sense, and all three of them can be naught. Though that's rather funny, because that value there doesn't make any difference at all, as long as it isn't zero. But because we don't leave any meanings, if they're all zero, that has no meaning whatever. This is not completely trivial. It's all got to be taken into account. That's all got to come into the, well, it comes in very naturally into the geometry once we get going. So what's the simplest example of a projective space? Well, I suppose the simplest would be over finite fields, but I leave those aside and just deal with real and complex fields. So the simplest one really is RP1, which is a set of pairs of real numbers modulo a real multiple here. So in other words, it's the set of equivalence classes of pairs of numbers, x and y, both just drawn from anywhere in the reals, where there's equivalence class, where that's equivalent to that for any real number lambda which is non-zero. Right, so that's easy to picture. Easy to picture because it's just the space, like just a two-dimensional graph. It's the space of rays through the origin. So I can then represent each ray by a point on the circle that it goes through. But then I notice that, of course, there's a funny problem because there are two points in the circle that it goes through. Or put another way, if I have think of it, this thing as an object which I rotate round, but I don't know, I can't tell this end from that end, and I rotate it around just by 180 degrees, I'm back to where I started. So the space actually is a circle, but it's a circle in which, once I've gone round here, I'm back to where I started. So it's a circle with opposite points identified, which is topologically still a circle, but it's not that circle. But that doesn't... That sort of gets us going, what we've got to do. And the point is that we can represent... Well, it gives rise to the following ideas. We can represent... We need two charts. Well, you can have as many as you like, actually, but we've certainly got to have two to do it like this. We can represent the ratio x to y by one u, where u is equal to y over x, where... as long as x is not equal to 0. So that covers all the points apart from what these, apart from the ray which is going up like that. All we can, and charts, that's chart 1 and chart 2 by V1, where V is x over y, where y is not equal to 0. So that's all the rays except the one which goes out in that direction. And since x and y are not allowed both to be 0, that covers all the space, but we do need these two charts. So that any other point, so these particular rays are only covered by one chart, but every other ray can be covered by either one or the other, and of course you've got a relationship between these, u of v has got to equal 1 on the overlap. So that seems a lot of fuss about nothing, but of course that's a lot less trivial in higher dimensions. I can show the mapping to a circle explicitly by saying, well, let me think of a circle as the unit circle in the complex plane. So it's just the complex numbers e to the I theta from 0 to 2 pi, and then the map theta goes to 1 tan theta over 2, which is the same thing as cot theta over 2. 1 is the mapping from the circle into this space. All right, that will do it. All right, well, that's not doesn't do very much. It introduces the idea that actually this idea of charts. So that if we just want to represent the projective object with something which is a number, yeah, then we can't do it all in one go. That we have to build it up out of pieces. This is only one way of doing it. There are other ways you could do it, but this is one convenient way. Now the next stage is to go on to RP2, which is much more content to it. And what I really want to get onto is the complex ones, but I'll think about RP2 first. But again, it's easy to... So it's R... So it's a set of, likewise, it's a triads of real numbers, but with the equivalence class given by non-trivial multiplication of the whole vector. And so again, this is just rays through the origin in free space. Not so easy to draw. It's, again, undirected rays. So that, again, if I rotate this ray around by 180 degrees, I'm back to where I started. And so it's easy to see what that is, Jim. As I could represent, I can draw a sphere here, and each ray will pierce the sphere into antipodal points. So it's actually equivalent to thinking about the sphere divided by, well, S naught, which is S naught being just 2 points. And that's not so trivial, because if you think of this as a surface, I'm not going to dwell on this because it's not really where we're going, but I mean that's what gives the very non-trivial global aspects of projective spaces. Now, the resulting surface doesn't have an orientation, and it's easy to see, because if you imagine yourself sitting on the globe here with a signpost saying north and east like this, and then you look at the antipodal reflection of that signpost, the east will still be pointing east, but the north will be pointing south. It will be wrong, so it has the opposite orientation. And another way of looking at that is the classical way of thinking of this. Sorry, I should give this a name here. This is the real projective plane. If we forget the origin in its in definition, just think about its global topology. In other words, just do a homeomorphism here. We can map this onto a square where there's identifications are made. This is the topologist's way of thinking of it rather than the algebraic geometer's way of thinking of it. And this is something where, and you can think of this, the topology here is really, I mean, these identifications give you the whole topological structure, a whole global picture of what we're doing, which isn't what I'm going to be concentrating on, but it still shows the non-trivial nature of what we've got into. And it's quite, I mean, it's quite hard to visualize. It means that if you take a walk on the plane and hit that, the edge there, you come back over here, and moreover, your orientation will be switched over. You could then walk to here, and then you'd pop out again, and here, again, with the orientation now reversed to what it was originally. And then you get back to your starting point. It would be quite nice to have a computer game or something in which you could imagine this would be easy to implement with a screen scrolling, and would give you a real feeling for trying to understand the geometry of RP2 by having to locate objects in a game. But I'm not going to try and do anything like that, because the point is not the complexity of this. This is not what's important for what we're doing. So this is fascinating and marvelous in the classification of surfaces and to do with the Klein bottle and cross caps and all sorts of things. But actually, the whole point is this is marvelously simple. Now this is difficult, but what we're actually going to want to use is something extremely simple. Because what are the linear structures in this space? Well, the point is that a point in this space just corresponds to a ray, in other words, a one-dimensional vector subspace of R3, and a line we can define to correspond to a two-dimensional vector subspace of R3. And that, if you make that definition, so that point, that's a point in RP2, that's a one-dimensional subspace of R3, and a line, it's just defined to be a two-dimensional subspace of R3. That's all we've got, because there's any, otherwise we've got the whole thing. Now, every two distinct points define a line, and every two distinct lines define a point. And that's what we need. That's a simple thing, and that's simpler than R2, which you might think, because of the existence of parallel lines in R2, which don't have a point in common. I mean, that concept of parallel lines goes away, because all lines are on the same footing. Every two distinct lines meet in exactly one point. And that's a much simpler structure. Now again, I can... how am I going to give coordinates for these? So that's a simpler than R2, where you have a concept of parallel lines, and that's because, well, introducing a coordinate chart will bring out added extra points, in fact, a whole RP1's worth of points, which correspond to what's called the line at infinity, where these lines can be thought of a meeting. But of course, that's just a way of talking. I mean, that makes it sound as though it's sort of hand-waving about infinity. It's not really at all. It's just an extremely simple fact about subspaces of R3. So if I wanted to do that, I'll need three. I could give coordinates to RP2 with three charts. Would do. Of course, I could give loads. I could give a million charts if I wanted with overlap conditions, but three will do. So I might have one okay, that's my general point in RP2 here, but I can represent it by that triple if z is not equal to naught, so that u is then x over z and v is y over z. And similarly, that's chart one. I can give two other charts in a similar way. So this, what this does then, it takes the whole of RP2, slices out the ones which are zero in the third component, and maps those onto R2. And those ones I've had to leave out, because they can't be represented in this chart, that becomes the RP1 at infinity, which is roughly like the horizon of visual representation in photography or art, except that you have to remember that the horizon isn't actually a whole circle around us. It's a circle with opposite points identified. So it's not actually the same circle as you might look at as a physical horizon. All right, so there's enough structure in here to see an important idea of dual structure coming out, because what's the equation of a line? I said a line is a two-dimensional subspace. So a line is the set of x, y, z, of ratios x, y, z, such that lx plus my plus nz is equal to naught for some lmn. But of course, that itself is a projective condition on lmn. Because any multiple of LMN will define exactly the same line. So a given subspace, it again gives you a different projective structure as a dual projective structure. So that's an extremely natural idea. The dual RP2. And you can look, in fact, and see what these... An example would be then if I take the line given by example, here are two lines, 1, 1, 1, and 1, 1, 2. If I try putting those, if I look at those lines in this chart, that first one will look like u plus v plus 1 is equal to naught, and the second one will look like u plus v plus 2 is equal to naught. And of course, those are parallel lines in that chart, but that's because they meet perfectly all right, of course, in 1, 1, 0, which is a perfectly good point in RP2. It's just the very point, it's just one of the RP1's worth of points which can't be represented in this chart. So that's what I actually mean by parallel lines meeting at a point in infinity. So that's only a way of speaking, and this... this is the exact way of describing it. As an example of non-trivial fact in the projective plane, which doesn't get into all the stuff about the global topology, but it actually shows the non-triviality even of the concepts of lines and points, I thought I would... This is with David Skinner's suggestion. I can blame him, he isn't... fallen asleep, so, all right. All right, so I thought I would illustrate what non-triviality, even of this just two-dimensional structure, by giving a proof of Pappus's theorem, which of course is hardly news. I mean, this is something that's known about 2,000 years ago, but it's very interesting to see. And also the techniques, which I'll show you for proving it, are very, very similar to the techniques used in projective spaces that we use in these calculations with momentum twisters and the and the rest of it. So the theorem is this. If I have two sets of collinear points on any two lines, and I join them pairwise, one and two, that defines a certain point, the 1-2 point, and then the 2-3 point, and then finally the 1-3 point, that those three points must be collinear. And that's not at all obvious. It's not actually particularly easy to prove, but it is notably a statement purely about collinearity and concurrence, which is nothing to do with measurements, you see. It's got no concept of measuring distances. Now, there are classical proofs of this which would bring in the concept of measuring distances, about ratios, and they measure distances and find ratios between them and so forth. But actually, that concept of distance depends on choosing a particular chart in which to represent this structure and then using the coordinates in that chart. I mean, elegant ways of doing that. And there's nothing against doing that. But actually, that isn't essential to the nature of the thing. The other problem is that although I've drawn it like this, I have by drawing it on the blackboard, which is an R2, I've implicitly chosen a chart for doing it. I mean, that's part of my representational act, you see. But actually, for instance, it could be that this line could be the line to infinity. And all that would mean is that this line would be parallel lines in the picture, or it could be that this line turns out to be the line to infinity, which would give rise to a different picture, and then Euclidean terms would mean a different statement. Instead of what I'd said, you'd have to make a different, you'd have to translate it all into a different language about if they're parallel and some other ones and so forth. But we wrapped up all those, quite a large number of different cases, into just one statement in RP2. So it's slightly foreign to the nature of the thing actually to go into a chart and then out again, taking all those exceptional cases. And it's much nicer to prove it directly using the algebraic geometry of the projective space. So I'm going to introduce a little bit of notation here. The points, those are stated to be, how do I translate that? Well, that means I introduce the epsilon tensor here, which is just a determinant, in other words. And if I've got three points, one to x1, x2, and x3, it means that is going to be naught. And although, of course, these are not numbers, but they represent sets of ratios, that equation is one which is projective, because it doesn't matter which representation it is. I mean, it's like a statement about the harmony and not about the picture of the chord that's being played. I might write that for short. Well, I could borrow our bracket notation that we use a lot in the amplitude theory. But actually, it's slightly better to use this notation here. You can think of this as an epsilon turned on its side. So these mean just the same thing here. These are just, all they mean is the epsilon with three indices attached to the three vectors. So similarly, if I've got three lines, well, that's a dual statement about XA. Let me see. Perhaps I better call them dual variables. No, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter where. Why, I think. And I might write that as ABC equals naught, or ABC like that. So, you know, the point is, they're very simple ideas. These are just determinants. Aren't they? These are just 3x3 determinants. So they're all basically a very simple idea. All right, I need that. And then I can write down what it is that I'm trying to establish, which is the collinearity of those points. But I need a little bit of epsilon stuff, which is just the same epsilon stuff as we tend to use in the physics. And one of them is, you should be is a well-known thing for the product of contraction of two epsilons, which I can write. Sorry, I've drawn too many things there. 1, 2, 3, 1. It's equal to, it's that minus that, where these represent deltas. Use that in a minute. And the other thing is Schuiten's identity, which means that, here's one way of looking at it. It means that if I take epsilon onto anything and another vector, and then I intersymmetrize on all four things, I get zero. So that's Schuiten's identity. I need those two things, and they're typical of what we're doing in this all the time. Right, so I'll bring in those two things, and with that, all right, so I think if I move this up, now I can write down the object which I'm investigating, and that's the epsilon onto the three points which arise as the meeting of the six lines in those way. So what I can, so I've got to consider this object, 1, 2 primed, 1 prime 2, (2, 3 primed), 2 prime 3. And this is a 3, 1 primed, 3 primed 1. That's it, I've got to consider that. If that's naught, then those three points are collinear. That's the condition. Is it naught? That's the point. If it isn't naught, it hasn't got any invariant meaning at all, but if it is naught, then it means the three points are collinear. All right, well, I have the identity that I can, about that one, that allows me, I can move that. I can move this one onto the top, and so that gives me (3 primed, 2 primed, 3), where this here, that means, it means the symmetrized, anti-symmetrized deltas, minus that. If I apply that again, I can apply this idea again and just evaluate these two pieces here. And so the next stage you get, I'll use the other notation here. Minus the same thing, but with primes interchanged. That just gives that object. Which everything, oh, it's just my writing, I think. Everything should be connected.
It looks like a solid box. The top line on that.
Well, I think, oh, here, up here.
No, if you have 1, 2 prime, 1 prime 2,
oh, yes, I think there is something. Yes, I beg your pardon, there is something wrong here, yes. It should be, yeah, that's right. That was what was wrong. Thank you very much. Right, if you just like the others. Yeah, thank you. No, very helpful. Yeah, I mean, there's no difference between these three things. I could. Yeah. All right. So if I add naught to this, and naught I write in a funny way, that minus its primed version. You see, that's naught because it's self-primed, you see. So it's if I prime it, I just get itself back again, so I subtract it off, I get naught. So I add that to that, or subtract it, and it's got those on the left-hand side. That is, no, that one's common with that, and that one's common with that. So I get another expression, which is, and I got 1 prime 2. I get an anti-symmetrized object here from the remaining product. I get that. And I'm not very interested in these factors, but I'm very interested in this thing here. Now, Schuten's identity tells him I can swap over that pair with that pair. That follows, that's the equivalent to Schuten's identity. So if I do that, I get 1 prime 2, 1, 3, and then 3 prime 2. But now you stare at this thing, and sorry, have we got, have I, all right, that's 3 prime, no, the whole point is, oh, beg your pardon. No, I've skipped ahead of myself. I've written the first line. Yeah, sorry. This line, what I get from here would have been this. And I'm sorry, I've skipped a line ahead. Because now what I get by swapping them over, this is what I want to get here. Yeah, that's 3 prime 2. But now this epsilon, that's 1 prime 2, that can't hit this 2 because that gives naught, because there's 1 prime 2, 2. Which is naught. So what that gives is these two things times the other thing that you can, the only other thing it can be, which is 1 prime 2, 3 primed, and the other thing is 1, 2, 3. But that expresses the clinearity of 1, 2, 3 in the original picture. The fact that that is 0 is because 1, 2, 3 are given to be clinear. So that's equal to naught, and of course its prime version is also naught, so that's equal to naught. It is indeed naught. So that proves the clinearity of the 3-point. Sorry about that muddle, but that's, anyway, that does it. So that does it without any business of choosing charts and things, which is, so in a way it respects the whole projective nature of the thing. And really what we're doing is just transforming a 12th order homogeneous polynomial in 6 variables using these epsilon identities. In a way which is very similar to manipulations we have to do with these amplitudes when they're expressed in projective variables. So it's interesting that these simple concepts of clinearity and concurrence, and of course if we've got one more dimension to coplanarity as well, we're just getting enhanced versions of these ideas. They come in even at this classical level. They're sort of sitting there in the very nature of geometry that they give rise to this sort of algebraic operation. All right, well, it's really complex projective spaces that I want to go on to, but and there are differences, but one of them things isn't different in that all our intuitive ideas about point, line, and plane, at least the incidence properties, are exactly the same in the complex as in the real. In other words, I could have stated this as a theorem in the complex projective plane, CP2, it's just as we'll see, all the actual, the global shape of these subspaces is different, but the incidence, all the algebra here will look exactly the same if they represent complex numbers as if they are real numbers. So it's no more difficult. It's exactly the same. And as long as we just suitably interpret the concepts, the clinearity, concurrence and so forth, plane and so forth, it will just go over. So in that way, the algebra is no more difficult at all, and moreover, we can get an intuitive idea of what it means by this real model of what line and plane and so forth mean. So global topology with difference, and I'll discuss that a little bit, but the algebra is essentially the same, though one thing's not the same. It's the same for linear things, but of course the fundamental theorem of algebra means that we can solve any polynomial equation in the complex in a way you can't counts on in the real, complicated conditions about things being positive or negative, and that that means that things are much simpler in the complex because every polynomial has its quota of roots sitting there. All right, so with that in mind, I look at the, remind you, because I'm sure you're really entirely familiar with this, of the simplest complex projective space, which is CP1. And here, because it's essentially two real dimensional, there's non-trivial structure even at this first dimensional level, which is, again is surprisingly worthwhile, even though it's only a reformulation of things you might know perfectly well already. So we've got CP1. So it's the space of complex ratios where two points, well, exactly the same as for the real, and so two points are equivalent if when multiplied by a non-zero complex number. One is related to the other by a non-zero complex multiple. And of course that gives rise to the Riemann sphere. So it has the topology of a sphere, and it's notably not the product of a RP1 by itself. It's completely different. And I won't go through, and the charts idea is exactly the same as in the real case. And in fact, in the real case, I could have drawn, there's a particular way of drawing the map which takes a point on the sphere to a point on the complex plane, namely by stereographic projection. That's a very nice way of seeing how the two charts work. You'll have one chart which excludes one possible ratio here, which I'll call infinity, and by projecting by a straight line from that point, and there'll be another chart which you do the opposite and project from the zero here, and you'll get a different coordinate, but they're related. All right, so I won't go through that sort of chart business again, because it's essentially exactly the same. I mean, it's nothing changes. It's just that things have got a complex rather than a real meaning, but the global topology is different. It's a sphere. Now, of course, this has added interest for us because it actually is the space of projective spinners. So actually, I may well refer to objects in this space as being spinners and think of them as projective spinners, rather than as being a complex variable z that's part of our motivation here. This is a very natural space for us to be interested in for all sorts of reasons. All right, so I won't go through the sort of incidence things again, because there's not much. What's more interesting now is how integration looks. That's something that really has much more content in the complex than it does in the real. So let's look at a very simple thing that you learn at the beginning of complex calculus, and I'll write it in a particular way. I won't bother with the details of where the contours got to surround them, one and the other, and so forth. But that essentially you have that is one. So dz then. That's in C, where I've got two distinct A and B, and I've got a contour which separates the A and the B. How can I translate that? Well, I am going to translate that into the language of CP1 and show that it has an interesting structure. In fact, it's easy to translate, and let's do the dictionary for that. I'm going to think of myself as doing this in a certain chart, and then I'm going to throw away the chart. So I'm going to represent the z. I'll map z into the point. in CP1, whose representation in a certain chart is 1z, and I'm going to call that point ZA, projective, think of that as a projective spinner, ZA, and that will mean, and then DZ is actually, I'm going to write that in a funny way, but it's a very sensible way, and it's actually going to be written as that. Of course, that first term is the only one. That's just 1 times dz, and that times 0, but there's a good reason for writing it in that way, which will immediately become clear. And similarly, I'm going to map A and B to projective spinners alpha and beta, and then I can just go ahead and translate all the elements in here, and they become, well, I'm actually introducing the epsilon symbol here implicitly here, because when I raise an index here, I'm doing it with a two-index epsilon symbol, because I'm treating that as standard ideas. And so now the important thing is that becomes into the projective one form here. Now the point about this one form here, written in this way, is invariant under changes of, I've chosen an arbitrary chart here, but whichever chart I chose, this would be, if I make a Möbius transformation, which is, in other words, a special linear transformation here, that will be invariant. But in this combination, namely when this thing, which is a homogeneity 2 in the Zs, is combined with an integrand, which is a degree minus 2 in the Zs, then in fact I could transform the Z by any general linear transformation, non-singular linear transformation, and this object will be invariant. So the fact that it only involves, see, that's an epsilon there. So that's epsilon AB Z A DZ B. So the fact that this, that's why I wrote it in that way, because any linear transformation, any special linear transformation will leave that invariant, and so this invariant up to scale, but the fact that it's actually the right homogeneity here, plus 2 there, and then minus 2 from the denominator, means that it actually extends to any general linear transformation. So this is a completely invariant concept, and a genuine projective object here. Now, what's the point of doing this? You might have thought this is much simpler. Well, it includes every case. It's like the thing with the... It's a bit like the thing with Pappas's theorem. And the thing is... Yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah, that's right. So this is just shorthand here for... this would be epsilon A, B, Z, A, alpha. Yeah, like that. Yeah. That's right. So raising and lowering with the epsilon is just taken for granted. That's right. So there's nothing here that isn't left invariant here, because that's just the epsilon contraction. All right. So what's nice about this is that, you see, I've got a picture of a sphere with just 2 projective spinners on it, alpha and beta. And it doesn't care whether I can call one of them naught and one of them infinity if I like, or I can call them A and B if I like. I can do anything I like here. And this, it brings together this thing, which I have to be careful, A can't be, doesn't mean anything, so A is infinity, or B is infinity, but here it's completely all on the same footing. And in complex analysis, that's a rather nice thing, because it's very awkward to say, see, we've also got dz over z. And how does that link with this? Well, you could guess it by saying, well, I'll take a limit as B tends to infinity. And then typically in elementary complex analysis, you do analyze things like this by saying big circles at infinity and so on, and then you're doing power counting at infinity and so on. But really, all those arguments, and you have big circles at infinity and little weenie circles around other points, but they're already the same. A big circle at infinity in the complex plane is just a little circle around the point corresponding to infinity in CP1. So it puts all these things on the same footing and restores the whole symmetry in this. In particular, you can see that the distinction between the minus 1 power of z and any other power of z there, which means that this integral is 1 rather than 0, is precisely because of the topological property that it's got it's the sphere punctured by 2 points rather than just by 1. So it turns something which is sort of an evaluation of an integral here into something which is purely to do with shape, that this is something which is which is not simply connected here, because it's got two points which are singular in CP1, whereas if it's some other power, other integer power of z here, you'd only have one singular point, either at infinity or at naught. So it restores a very nice symmetry. Well, that doesn't, of course, just for that, that's not sort of terribly interesting, but that extends some more interesting objects. In particular, in this point of view, it's not particularly natural to pick out 0, 1 and infinity as preferred points, as people often like to do. It's really just as handy to leave them as arbitrary points here. And in particular, the concept of the cross ratio emerges very easily, so I think I'll just make a comment about that. All right. Well, I'm not going to do any more calculations like this one. in particular, one thing I've already mentioned, but what are Möbius transformations? What do they look like in this picture? Well, Möbius transformations are just form z goes to, I usually thought of like that. But of course, those are just linear on the underlying C2 in the so they're just of the form the matrix, but the pair Z1 Z2 goes to that matrix multiplying in it. So Möbius transformations are simply just linear transformations on the on CP1. In fact, they're just the only holomorphic maps from CP1 into itself. Of course, this itself is a projective idea, because it's only the ratios of A to B to C. This is redundant here. I mean, there's one degree of freedom too many in that representation. And of course, that gives rise to a lot of subtlety about the twofold cover and so forth. But this is, again, a projective concept. So it's only got three degrees of freedom, which is why any three points in CP1 can be mapped to any other three points in CP1. But any four points have an invariant under any Möbius transformation. But four points have an invariant cross ratio. And of course, this is the beginning of all the stuff about these invariants. If I have four points, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, I can define these dots are, again, contractions with the epsilon here. It's really a class of objects of that nature, because by permuting alpha, beta, and gamma, and delta, I get various different transformations on this. So if alpha corresponds to 0, 1, and beta to, so it corresponds to either 0, 1, and infinity, if you like, then that's the fourth point, then that z is equivalent to this cross ratio. But if I'd permuted alpha, beta, and gamma, because there's no particular reason why I should choose in that order, so permuting, that gives rise to, that will change, you'll get these familiar transformations where Z goes under this group of transformations, which is just the group of six things that you can do here, which make a difference. You get these things. And so that's a very familiar object. So these transformations can be represented by choosing also a basis, but permuting the basis parameters alpha, beta, gamma. And of course, yeah, these 3 degrees of freedom, that's particularly interesting, that's 3 complex degrees of freedom, and that's, of course, 6 real dimensional manifold of possibilities, and that's particularly interesting from a relativistic point of view, because 3 of those parameters can be thought of as to do with rotations, and the other 3 as boosts. So the whole thing is actually isomorphic, or locally isomorphic, to the Lorentz transformation. So that's another reason for our interest in this representation, and in really where the spinner representation comes into physics. All right, so that so the Möbius transformations take on a particularly simple role. They're just linear transformations, and they're just things which move the spinners around in a holomorphic way. Essentially trivial. That's the idea. I mean, really, things are defined up to Möbius transformations, really. So that's what we're really doing. If I extend it from that 1 over z minus a, 1 z minus b, I might have any polynomial. I mean, a typical thing we might be interested in is any rational function here of z. Now, how does that appear in the CP1? Well, that would just, because we're in the complex field, we can always we can factorize any polynomial factorized into its root. So it's really the most general thing of this nature is I'll have these poles, which could, of course, be coincident. But here's a subtlety. Here's the only part which is interesting. You'll get another term which reflects the, let's call that I for infinity there, to the power of n minus 2 there. So this corresponds to, so that could be a numerator or it could be a pole here, depending on the relative size of m and n here. I mean, this is the structure, so that's with the projective form there. So the whole thing's got, that's got to have degree minus 2 to have projective meaning when combined with the projective 1 form here. So that translating this brings to light the behavior at infinity of this function. Of course, that's just power counting. There's nothing very subtle about that. It's just counting. It's just counting whether the behavior at infinity. And of course, this puts in a more geometrical way the kind of argument that goes into validity of BCFW, talking about the behavior of the function of z as z tends to infinity, and the power there. In this point of view, that type of discussion about asymptotic behavior is encoded into whether there's a pole at infinity or not. And the validity of the BCF expansion depends on the fact that there's not a pole, and so it's you get naught as when you take a large circle, take a small circle around infinity, which is equivalent to take a big circle and you get to pick up the sum of all these terms without any extra term. Beyond rational functions, there's one, I'll just mention a couple of beautiful things which mean that even CP1 has a lot that's not obvious to say about itself. And let me draw this picture, which is a trefoil knot contour here. This is a sphere with a contour which runs around in this way, and it's a knot because there are branch. These are going to be have branch points, and that's the complex power A here, and B at the other one, the beta, and C at the gamma, and I'll put in these. This is in unit leading singularity style, so that and that gamma of A, gamma of B, gamma of C, that's equal to 1. That is a representation of the Euler's beta function integral in a completely symmetrical form between three points in CP1. Which is, the way you can see that is, what you'd normally think of that is an integral between 0 and 1 of some power of z and some power of 1 minus z in the complex plane. How do you translate that into that? Well, it's because if I think, take this loop here, imagine pulling it round the back of the sphere, and then you can, then this trefoil knot you can write in a more asymmetrical way as a concept which goes round here, back there, round there, round there, round there. And that's the same thing as e to the, that's 1 minus e to the 2 pi I b times 1 minus e to the 2 pi I c times that line integral. But of course I could have done it the other ways as well, so equally well. So you get all these different results summed up into one symmetric form here, which is essentially that is the beta function. And so this pulling around of contours gives you a much more symmetrical way of thinking of what's going on with this calculation. And that extends the definition of the hypergeometric function in a way which makes the complicated relationships between the different branches and different arguments a lot more transparent. Since I can take the same contour here, let me just extend this. I think that's alpha, beta, but now I've got a gamma and another delta, which I surround together with it, and I consider, again, the projective form. This is due to Klein, it's all over donkey's ears old, but it's not as familiar as it might be. I should have mentioned there's a condition on A, B, and C here. Of course, A plus B plus C has to equal 2. B, Z, B, Z, gamma, C, Z, alpha, D. If I consider that integrand, A plus B plus C plus D now is equal to 2. Well, now when I've got four points on the sphere to dodge, there are loads of ways I could do that, you see. I could do it that way, or I could have combined under the other pairs together, all sorts of things I could do. Or I could do a symmetrical one like that. I mean, there are countless ways to do that. But by the same operations as I indicated here, I can relate all of those to classical line integrals. And in that way, by relations between contours, reconstitute the relations between different branches of the hypergeometric function. So that's where they all come from. And that's the symmetrical way of looking at where all those things to do with the hypergeometric function arise. As I've got it, see, this is something which is going to reduce to the gamma function when gamma's equal to delta. So it's an expansion. I haven't got it prepared in the details of this. The point is you get something which is of the form of a certain hypergeometric function with parameters depending on A, B, and C here, and it's the cross ratio here, which is naturally, it's a function of. So the value of the integral that you get here will be, depending on which contour you've taken, will be a hypergeometric function with some stuff here to do with the gamma function, which is just conventional normalization. But the business part, this is, the hypergeometric function actually is a function of the cross ratio, and the permuting of alpha, beta, gamma, delta corresponds to all those things with z going to 1 over z and 1 minus z and 1 over 1 minus z and all that stuff. So that turns all those transformations into ideas of just transforming the contour of various permutations. And a particular case of this would be where A and B and C and D were all a half. That gives rise to the elliptic functions. That's just a special case. And again, it gives a much more symmetrical picture of the elliptic functions and the square root cuts that you can go around in these two different ways to get the torus worth of stuff. And also shows how it doesn't really matter whether you think of it as a quartic denominator or a cubic denominator. A cubic denominator in the elliptic function is just one where one of the roots has gone off to infinity. So it really is the same thing. I think I've actually used up my time now, so I think people should be willing, just if, as long as people feel no hesitation about leaving because they have other things they prefer doing. That's, I don't mind. Yes, you could use this picture as a nice way to get high. Yeah, but this is just, this is the F1. So, yeah, so naturally you look at, you extend this picture. That's a helpful thing to do. I mean, the classical, what you get is the classical Gauss's form of hypergeometric function as a power series is where you think of these two as coinciding, and then you expand in the parameter which measures how far gamma and delta have come apart, you see, and that's how you naturally get this as a power series in this object here. See, that bit where you think of thinking of keeping the contour fixed, and then you move the things apart a little bit, and just by normal things about convergence, if this is the small displacement, you'll get a convergent power series. So that's a way of looking at it. So that's nothing really specially new. I mean, that's just really completely ordinary analysis. But what is different, I think, from the usual formulation is that you have this combinatorial picture of how the different branches arise and derive identities relating the different branches with very, very, relatively easily, really. I was going to say a little bit about, that's just CP1, that's a lot of structure. I mean, these are things, certainly if we're talking about, I mean, dilogarithms are special limiting cases of hypergeometric functions. So in fact, you could easily write a dilogarithm as where these become logarithms, essentially. So you've got a log and a log, and another inverse square power that will give rise to dilogarithm. But really, it's probably more natural to think of dilogarithms arising from CP2 with purely rational things, rather than sticking logs in and getting a dialog out. But that's certainly one way to represent them. So these representations are certainly relevant to all the functions that people are concerned with, and the emergence of these cross ratios seems to be very close to the emergence of these big dilogarithmic, polylogarithmic functions across ratios. And they're an indication that there's some basic geometrical idea underlying these apparently complicated functions and the non-trivial identities relating their different branches. So that's a reason for putting them in this projective form. So I think that was the point of my remark here. Other reasons, all sorts of reasons are interested in complex projective spaces, which of course aren't as immediate in everyday life as the currency fluctuations and so forth, but nevertheless actually are here in reality all the time, since a quantum state is itself a complex projective object. And if I have a state, if I have just a spin up and spin down quantum system, usually that's written as a linear superposition of the two. But of course, that's really a projective space there, because there's no way physically of distinguishing this thing from a complex multiple of itself. I mean, the relationship between two such things has a meaning, but if you're just given a state, you have no way of measuring its absolute value. It's not what wave functions are like. So there might be spin up and spin down, in which case you've actually got a very natural connection with the sphere, because the spin sideways and saying are just the same as just the Riemann sphere. That's exactly what it is. But this might also be cat alive and cat dead, or through the buckyball, through the slit, or not through. I mean, all these fascinating questions about quantum mechanics are actually, for two states, for vector, for Hilbert spaces of two dimensions, that's just the CP1. But of course, in general, that's going to be CPN, with n as some large, very large number. So we are interested in topology and structure of CPN for all sorts of reasons. What is the topology of CPN? Well, that's actually surprisingly easy to answer, because it's the space of. So this isn't really, again, I'm going to emphasize, this isn't really the thing that which makes it so good to use, because what's so good to use is that the topology of the algebraic geometry of CPN just takes over from the planes and hyperplanes and so forth. That's just as easy to visualize as in the real spaces. But if we want, then we can think, we can know in fact that the CPN can be thought of as a space of circles, or certain, well, this is roughly speaking, but on a S, on a comp of a sphere of dimension 2n plus 1. So this has got 2n real dimensions, and this has got 2n plus 1 dimensions, but if you factor out this space by a certain class of circles, got a hop fibering, then in fact what you get is the CPN, and that's easy to make explicit, because if I'm given an object in CPN, which is now a set of ratios Z1 to Z2 to Z3 up to Zn, I can choose representative Z1, Z2, Z3 up to Zn by demanding, so I can almost choose a chart, you see, by demanding that the sum of the squares is equal to 1. But that doesn't fix what they are, because I could multiply all of them by another e to the I theta. And I mean, in other words, that this choice is only fixed up to an overall e to the I theta. So if I take this space, but this is an S2n plus 1, because I can just write that as x1 squared plus y1 squared, x2 squared plus y2 squared, and that's the definition of what an S2n plus 1 is. But then if I divide that out by the circles, which are, in other words, the equivalence class of points which are related by that transformation, then I will get a unique point corresponding to that set of ratios. So that's surprisingly simple. That's the hop fibering. In particular, the CP1, the sphere that I thought that I wrote down before, is actually can be thought of as an S3 fibered by the circles on circles thus defined on an S3. Of course, that's not a direct product. That's essentially indirect product here. You can't think of the points on the S3 as being given by the direct product of using a point on a sphere and a point on a circle. It's something completely different. All right, so that's surprisingly easy. And we will need a little bit of that. But actually, I want to emphasize the simplicity of the algebraic geometry rather than anything that's vital about the global part of it. And the simplicity, I'm going to hop over CP2 and look at CP3. And so we now got four component objects defined up to ratios. And so as I'll actually be thinking about twisters, well, I'm going to think these are ratios, if you like, right? So that's defined up to complex multiplication in the simple way. Now, so again, you see, it's just a point here. It's just a one-dimensional subspace of C4. Right, and the line is a two-dimensional subspace of C4, and a plane is a three-dimensional. So any two points, any two distinct points, define a line. And any two distinct planes also define a line. Again, so the whole problem of parallel lines and so forth goes away. Although we can't have let me expand a bit more on what we get. So any two points and it's defined by the skewing of them. So it's represented by a skew tensor there. And if I have three, that defines a plane in the obvious way. And again, because these are only projectively defined, they're defined up to complex multiples. But now I can write that as an object in the dual space here. So I can define W as, let me write, yeah, yeah. using the alternating four tensor. And then that's so a dual object that naturally defines a plane. And a point in the space may or may not lie. Given a point and a plane, it may be that the point lies in the plane, or it may not. So given a z and a plane, the condition that the point lies on the plane couldn't be simpler, could it? That's all right. And of course the planes obviously form a dual CP3. But the lines don't. These objects do not form a vector space. Because if I add two things of that form, I don't necessarily, in general, I won't get another thing of the same form. So these don't form. This is a new feature of going up to this dimension. We wouldn't see this one dimension below. These don't form a vector space. They're not closed under linear combinations. The thing that does form a vector space is the space of all skew tensors here. And these are not any old skew tensors. These are skew tensors of the rank 2. That's what they are. Whereas a skew tensor can have rank 4. And a typical sum of two objects of this type does have rank 4. So that's very important. By these, the lines do not, as they stand, don't form a vector space. They don't give you a projective space. What you've got actually is a six-dimensional vector space, so it's of anti-symmetric things of the form P alpha beta, where these could be either rank 4 or rank 2. The rank 4 is the general case. Yeah. And the ones that arise by this multiplication and anti-symmetrization are rank 2. So they only form a subspace of this, and it's not a linear subspace. All right, so this is actually the point which twisted geometry takes off from, and this is not that it's invented as twist theory. This is all known to Klein and probably people long before in the last century, but it's all taken on new life now. So this actually forms this. So that C6 means really CP5, because because the condition of being anti-symmetric here is a projective condition. So it gives you a CP5. And what is the condition? Given an object of this, can I tell, given that you hand me an object of this kind, how can I find out whether it's a rank 2 or a rank 4? Well, the answer is, these are the objects, the lines are those P's which satisfying that condition, which again is a projective condition, but which is non-linear. It's quadratic. So it defines a quadric in this CP5. Now, how many dimensions has this got? Well, you've got a five complex dimensional thing, and this is just one condition on it, so it brings you down to four dimensions. The twister theory starts off really from the observation that you can identify this four-dimensional space with complexified, compactified Minkowski space. I mean, I can't sort of go into all of that, but I'm just pointing out the origins within this very simple geometry of points and lines and planes, from which the crucial idea of twister geometry takes off. And it takes off in this 19th century thing, which is well understood donkeys years ago, and used in all sorts of stuff, but not thought of in physics, is that you have this representation of points. Essentially, they're compactified, and of course, when you compactify Minkowski space, you do something analogous to that horizon at infinity that's there even in the projective plane. It's just that it isn't just a point or a circle, but a whole light cone's worth of extra points that have to be added on as the extra structure. And when you've done that, you've got something which is well defined under the inversion operation, and it's actually now been completely well defined for points. Points in this space have a well defined inversion. Every point can be inverted to x over x squared, even though x squared is naught. That's the essential point. So that doing that is just a higher dimensional version of what I was talking about with the projective plane. I emphasize this non-linearity because I think it was the question I was asked last week about, given the twisters, how do you recover the, I think David Gross asked this, how do you, what is a formula for recovering the, given this, given such an object here, how do I recover the space-time point that it represents? And the point is, it's a non-linear formula, so that given a skew d alpha beta, I can think of that as, I can choose two representative twisters that generate. It doesn't matter which two I choose. And then it corresponds to a point given by one A up to sine anyway. Right, first you have to split the C4 into two parts. You need, that's equal to XA primed. Right, that's the connection. But the point is, this is a non-linear connection here. That's the essential point. But it's quadratic here, and it's got a normalizing quadratic down here. So it's not a... And the subtlety of the twister representation, the reason why it does things you couldn't naturally do just in space-time is because this is such a non-trivial connection here. So I should emphasize that point. And that non-linearity comes out of this essential idea that the simple skew twisters don't form a vector space. That's the essential point here. So the omega part is, to find this you need both where you have to know where infinity is. And of course, you have to know where an origin is for this, and that part of the twister is formed by contracting Z with an origin, with a two twister corresponding to the origin, and this one by contraction with the line corresponding to the null cone's infinity. So I can't go into all of that, but there is a. That's all. These are linear objects in the twister. That's what I'm getting at here. So that's just. These are just. That's bilinear in the twister, and that's bilinear as well. And the whole thing is of degree naught in the twister, but in a quite complicated non-linear way. I think actually that really is time. I think that really is time for me to draw a halt on this. And there are all sorts more things like the volumes of the tetrahedra that I was mentioning last time, and so forth. But I think that's really enough to anyone could take, but I think that thank you very much for questions and putting your corrections and things too. So. Admit. Oh, well, of course, all of this is very, I mean, one of the most important groups here is that the conformal group. I mean, implicitly I said when you compactify Minkowski space, the inversion operation becomes completely well defined without any exceptions. You don't have to say, oh, it doesn't apply to the null cone or this, that, or the other. So you don't have to rule out that every point has its inverse point there, and that's telling you that that you've got a complete representation of the conformal group. And that's, so what you're really doing is you're using the 4-to-1 representation of the conformal group by SU22 on the, which operates on the twister space here. So I mean that's an example of the group structure which is underlying this. So that's analogous to the representation of the Lorentz group by the SL2C on the spinners. I mean, it includes that. I mean, it just extends that because that's a special case where you just do the Lorentz transformations rather than the full conformal group. Yeah, so there's a massive amount of group structure.
In kindergarten, like the first four, we're doing
the real case. I guess RP3 would be the group manifold of SL3. Well, no, because O has the concept of distance measuring, and there's no distance measuring here. So you've just got GL. You've just got GL2. Yeah. You see, so you've just got the real, you've just got real linear transformations, not with a concept of a metric on it. Oh, I see. Perhaps you'd like to. I see. Now it's. I see. Can you identify? But it's not how I was thinking of it. I'm certainly thinking of certainly is the invariant structure under different groups that's brought out by these representations, like the way that the SL2C is coded into the Möbius transformations and so on. So, but well, I don't know. I mean, S3 is essentially the rotation group, and you could find all sorts of relations, I think.
And that just comes from the end of the assignment of the vector space of one information server from EL and to what. But we didn't care about the overall scale, so we need to do that. And then all the spaces of lines and planes and everything else inside the vector space, they all inherit that.
I mean, there's lots more to say. For instance, you can define the complex conjugate structure on twister space, which maps a twister into a dual twister, and that then you have a concept of the signature of space-time comes in and so forth. So you get other structure. So there's a great deal more geometric structure that goes into this, not at a more detailed level.